And you're listening to 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. It's 12 noon. It's now time for All Souls Forum.
Well, good day. Welcome to the All Souls Forum right here on KKFI. Today's program features Dr. Bernard Franklin. He's going to talk about our broken education system in America and the parts of America where we're doing it right and the parts of America, which is most of America, where we're doing it wrong. It's going to be an enlightening hour, and I hope you can join us for the entire show today. This program was recorded on November 17th of 2013 at the All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church in Kansas City, Missouri. We will follow our usual format. We'll have a short introduction, then we'll hear from Dr. Franklin, and then we will take a short break and we'll have a question and answer session after that before we wrap up the program for today. So without further ado, let us begin.
Good morning. My name is Doug Nelson, and welcome to the All Souls Forum. When Carolyn asked me to participate on the forum committee, I started going through my mind of people who I really thought would be dynamic and stimulating speakers, and our guest today is the first person I thought of. So I'm really excited to have an opportunity to introduce Bernard Franklin today. I first met Bernard and got an insight to his accomplishments when our daughters were playing volleyball in junior high and on a Saturday morning. He had to hurry out because he had to do some more work on a committee he was serving on. I said, well, what committee is that? And he said, well, I'm on the selection committee for the Rhodes Scholarship. That kind of got my attention. Bernard Franklin was the first African-American student body president at Kansas State University. At the age of 24, he was the youngest appointee to the Kansas Board of Regents. And at 28, he was the youngest chair of the Kansas Board of Regents. Through his brother's relationship with Martin Luther King III as a roommate in college, Bernard became a good friend of the King family and actually served as Coretta Scott King's personal assistant. Bernard has had numerous awards and leadership positions here in Kansas City as well as nationally. He is the president of the International Fraternity of Delta Upsilon. He is chairman of the board of the Satchel Paige Foundation, member of the KC Google Fiber Innovation Team, past executive director of the Kauffman Scholars, past president of Penn Valley Community College. Currently, he serves as vice president for Kansas State University and is the director of the Junior Achievement of Middle America. It is a great honor that I have that we have Bernard speaking today, and he's going to talk about why is it that here in the United States, the richest country in the world, that we have such failures with our education system? I think you'll find it interesting and compelling. Bernard Franklin.
Thank you. Good morning, friends. How are you? Ready for the game? Whether you're ready or not, the game's going to happen. So you can do something else or you can watch the game. I'm really glad to be here. Thank you, Doug. Warm invitation for offering this opportunity. For me, there's nothing more important than education. Nothing more important. Nothing. Nothing, nothing, nothing. So we're going to talk about that for a few minutes. But before I do, let me just tell you a quick story. Because I like stories. Stories kind of frame our time and kind of help put some context to it. A-Ray, I'm really glad to see you. I meant to say that, too. It's always good to see such a dedicated member of our community. You're phenomenal. Thank you. There was a young boy who lived with his parents, and this boy didn't have any other siblings. And dad would take him to bed at night, and they would offer their prayers. And the young boy, I just like to call him Ray Ray. That's just kind of a nice little urban name when I do this in that context. Ray Ray would pray, and they'd always end the prayer, or Ray Ray would always end the prayer with, God, would you bless me with a little sister? And so Ray Ray would pray this for weeks. He prayed it for months, nearly prayed it for a year. And then he stopped. Well, several months after he stopped, Dad took his hand and said, Ray Ray, let's go to the hospital. I want to take you to see Mom. And he went in the hospital and walked into Mom's room, and Dad walked over to the side of the bed and pulled the covers down. And Dad said, Ray Ray, I want to introduce you to your little sister. Well, friends, there was great excitement in this room. Not like it is in here. This is pretty quiet. Y'all are kind of getting your morning coffee settled and all that stuff. Well, Ray Ray was excited. I mean, he was jumping up and down. He was hollering and screaming. Nurses came rushing in and said, what's going on in here? And Ray Ray introduced them to his little sister. Well, after things calmed down for a minute, Dad took his hand and walked him on the other side of the bed. And Dad pulled the covers down, and Dad said, Ray Ray, I want to introduce you to your second little sister. Pandemonium, friends, pandemonium. This guy was just excited because not did he have one, he had two little sisters. Well, after things quieted down again, Dad took his hand and walked him back on the original side of the bed. Dad pulled down the covers a little bit more and said, Ray Ray, I want to introduce you to your third little sister. Well, friends, you can imagine what this little boy is feeling like to not only have one, not only to have two, but he has three little sisters. Well, things calmed down again, and being like Doug and I, you know, we think we have these teachable moments with our children. So Dad crossed his arms, and he stood before Ray Ray, and Dad said, Son, aren't you glad you prayed for a little sister? Sometimes our children are smarter than us. Ray Ray uncrossed his hands. He looked up at his dad and said, Yeah, Dad, but aren't you glad I stopped? Friends, I think there are a lot of children in our community who are praying. And they're not praying for sisters. They're not praying for brothers. I think there's a number of children in our community this morning who are waking up praying for food because they didn't have dinner last night. I think there are many in our community who are praying for a job because there are many in our community who would like to work even if it's at McDonald's. I think, friends, a lot of kids in our neighborhood right here, not far from where we're situated here, are praying for transportation. Perhaps they're praying for an education. Maybe even some of them are saying, I know I need education. How do I get it? When my mom has taken my Social Security number, and now I can't access financial aid because my credit is ruined. Friend, I had that number of times at Penn Valley. Students would come in only to find out that their mom had taken their Social Security number and they could not access financial aid because their credit was ruined. Friends, there are young people in our community who are praying for a number of things, and they're not praying for children. They're praying for a future. They're praying for moving ahead. I do a lot of work around imagination. I am fascinated with the gift that God's given us, the ability to imagine something better, something different, something far from where we are today. And it may be because of how I grew up. You see, my parents picked cotton. My parents were desperately poor. I describe it as squalor. I was born in Okmulgee, Oklahoma, out in the country, really, a community called Nuyaka, which is a Choctaw Native American and African American community back then. These people were just extremely poor. My parents were sharecroppers, meaning they picked cotton on somebody else's land, but they didn't get that income. They simply picked the cotton and got 25 cents or 50 cents a bushel. That's kind of how it was. So being born there was fun as a child because you run around because we didn't spend much time inside. Back in the country, back in the day, you only went inside when the weather was so extreme. You slept outside. You slept wherever you could sleep. You did your bath outside in this big iron tub. Mom cooked outside. Grandma cooked outside. We did our business, our personal business outside in that outhouse thing that I refused to go as a child, especially at night. And in the daytime, if we did go inside, chickens pecked at our feet because the wood floor had so many cracks in it. Excuse me. But that's where I was born. That's where I was nurtured in my early years. And I'll never forget my dad, my grandfather, who could not call me Bernard. He called me Peanut. And Grandpa was a great guy, but his English, his spelling wasn't quite good. But Grandpa said that there was something beyond this. And so Grandpa pulled me aside with his aluminum can of water that he always loved, this little aluminum can he'd fill up with water. He had his overalls. He had one strap on and one strap off. I just never forget that picture. He pulled me over to the really rickety stoop that he was sitting on, and he said, "Peanut, one day you're going to be a doctor." This is my first real encounter with imagination. First real encounter of imagining myself far, far, far beyond my circumstances. Far into a place where you just couldn't begin to think or imagine. But that lodged into my brain. And friends, I have a master's and a PhD in counseling psych, and we're learning so much about brain development. And I resonated. I did a forum last year at Texas Christian University on some of the leading brain researchers. And they were talking about how the brain is pretty much set up like a computer. It has files, it has a system, and it stores a memory. And I stored that vision. I stored that vision away. And I have to tell you, quite honestly, that's what really propelled me. I'm the oldest of seven. My parents moved to Wichita, Kansas, with Dad's attempt to get us out of squalor and to get to Boeing. Dad never reached Boeing. He ended up working at the post office in Wichita. But my dad refused. I put it in that context for all the feminists who are here. My dad refused to allow my mom to work. My mom really didn't want to work. She worked later in my high school days. Dad wanted my mom to be at home for us at school after we were done. So we would come home. Mom would help us with homework. Dad was really, he was so focused on his children not being squalor children that he said education is important. And I'll never forget my junior year, I came home and I had a C in chemistry. And I'll never forget Dad leaving the table in frustration. Didn't show a lot of emotion ever. But he showed enough emotion to say that day, "This is too important, and you've let me down, and I don't know how I'm going to pay for college. I have seven children, and if all of you come at subpar level, I'm not going to get this done." Friends, it kind of changed my perspective because I saw how much my dad wanted me to get my education, so I graduated from K-State. I graduated from high school, went to K-State, did the honors program the first semester because my father, that was huge, he wanted me to get that. At the time, I had my grandfather's vision. And so what did I enroll in? I enrolled in pre-med. Then we had a course for freshmen called physiology. Went to physiology class, did the first day. The second day, they rolled out a cadaver, paired us up by twos and said, "You're going to know every blood vessel, you're going to know every bone, you're going to know every muscle in this." That was it. I got out of pre-med and went into pre-dentistry. Third semester, I left pre-dentistry and went to med tech. Finally, I went and took a course, took a test, and I want to suggest it if all of you have children or grandchildren. It's the Strong Campbell, Strong Campbell, Campbell, interest exam that changed my life. Strong Campbell came back and said that my number one interest and talent is people, yes, public speaking. So I gave myself to that, speech 101, speech 2, speech 3, whatever I could do. Got involved in student government. Student government really helped hone my public speaking skills, which led to the Board of Regents, which led to my brother's connection with Mrs. King. Mrs. King got me an appointment to the Carter White House. At that moment, they sent me around the country to do public presentations. There was conversation about Bernard Franklin becoming senator from Kansas and moving on and on and on quite rapidly to the point when I was 28 years old. I said, this trajectory is going too fast. You see, I tell my students, I was the first Barack Obama. Let's just put it all on the table, be honest here. There was some real conversation about what this young guy from Kansas with this kicking afro could really do because he's a good speaker. So when I finished that trajectory that last weekend working in the Carter White House, I gave 12 high school and college graduations around the country. And understand, I'm 27, 28 years old. At the national level, you're given a script to go say whatever it is they want you to say. And you're given a set of wardrobe. This is what we want you to wear. This is the tie we want you to wear. We want you to make sure you focus on this person and this TV station and this trajectory. I felt too managed. I felt like my life was out of control. I'm a young man. I'm being told where to go, what to say, what to do, who to connect with, who to da 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 da. And I'm like, no, I'm out of here. So I came back to Kansas City, worked at Commerce Bank, did some other things. And then you've heard some of what I've done. Friends, I owe it. I owe it to a dream. I owe it to an imagination. I owe it to my grandfather. And oftentimes I'll stop and I'll dedicate my presentation to my grandfather. And so if you just excuse me for one moment. Grandfather, I'm here fulfilling your purpose. I'm here fulfilling that dream. You said I would be a doctor, and I thought it was a medical doctor. But here I am in front of these people, espousing some real interest around education because of the dream you gave me. And I'm sincere about that. I would not be here had not a grandfather given me vision and given me a support. So, friends, I'm here to really talk about where we are. And I know you've had some other people who've talked about education and talked about its impact, but I'm here to really talk about how is it that a rich country, how is it where our GNP is biggest than in anywhere in the world? How is it that we can't get this right? And I know there are some of you in this audience who probably could do this better than I could, but I'm going to give it to you from my perspective. I'm going to give it to you from my work, from my sense. And just put it in some real context, because you see, we are at a point where America's future is in great crisis. We are not graduating enough engineers. We're not graduating enough chemists. We're not graduating enough students in sciences to really keep us in the forefront of the world economy. India and China are graduating far more than we are. Their economies are exploding. We import more engineers and more scientists to our country, or we keep them here once they come to Stanford or Harvard or Johns Hopkins. We keep them here with incentives and all kinds of things because we're not graduating. Nearly 30% of our young people drop out of high school every year and never complete high school. The failures are occurring in every nook, every cranny in this country. And friends, we're beginning to see even more of this non-graduation rate slip into the suburbs. So we describe in the cities, you have kind of three rings. There's an urban core ring, which is your first ring right in the center. The second ring would be the ring, just enter into Johnson County, enter beyond Jackson County, a little around Clay County, Platt. That would be your second. And then your third would be the Olathes, the Blue Springs, the Blue Valley. That would be your third. We're seeing it now creep into the second ring, where the dropout rate is nearing that of the urban core. So if you begin to see that dropout rate move from the urban core into the second ring, you begin to understand that America's in great crisis. We can't continue this way. But why is it? What would hold us from having all of our young people have the degree? And friends, I believe some part of it is our own personal desire to accumulate wealth. Our own personal desire to accumulate wealth and to keep it. Now, one of the reasons I say that is 9 years ago, my wife died of breast cancer. It's a great challenging period in our lives. I have four children. The youngest is a girl who really went south, who really had some tremendous challenges after mom died. And it really shifted my work, shifted my whole perspective, but it really taught me something about education and taught me something about the tenacity that we must have as parents if we're going to work this thing through. We give up, and I was there. How was I there? Because I had a desire to maintain my middle class standing. I had a desire to make sure that my salary, my work was all that, and so my daughter was being neglected. And so when the final high school who called the Tuesday after Labor Day and said, Bernard, you need to come get your daughter. We've had enough. We dealt with her the year before. We're early into the semester, and she's very disruptive. Now, friends, I'm working at Penn Valley. I'm enjoying my role. I'm enjoying my work, but I'm at a crisis. It's either my maintain my position in this community, my maintain my wealth, or my take care of my daughter. It was hard, and I have to admit, as a man, but I gave up and said, it's my daughter. And so we redesigned our budget, redesigned our lives, so that I could homeschool her to get her back in place. And friends, I so value people who homeschool, because you're talking about being with your student, your son or your daughter, all day long. And you're talking about being present when they don't feel well, when they're not getting it, when she's just not getting math. And you know the answer. And you're on your seventh time, your seventh try. And you just want to say, I know. But I'm committed to doing that. The reason I say that is because one of the lessons, the many lessons I learned from my wife's passing, my wife didn't take anything with her. She didn't take any of that $500,000 life policy I had. She didn't take any of the clothes that I bought her. And the house that I built in Piper near the racetrack, she didn't take not one nail, not one piece of lumber. She took nothing with her. So what that resonated with me was, why am I working so hard to try to keep stuff when I have this child who really needs me to pour into her? And so, friends, we need more people in our community who are willing to step aside their comfort, their wealth, their stuff, so that we can help kids. You think about all the two-parent homes today. You think about all the stuff that we've accumulated, two cars, three cars. I know friends, I know them well. I know people who have two and three homes, and in every one of their homes there's an iPad or an iPod or an iPhone. And their children, when they go from the winter home to the summer home to the spring, they do not take a single electronic item with them because they're all at the other place. They don't pack. They simply get on a plane and they go. And I scratch my head and I say to my friends, how is it in America that we can continue to consume and continue to get more, but yet we do nothing for the very ones who need it? Part of our whole issue in this country is this whole issue of wealth disparity. And that's probably a whole other conversation about how we do it. Am I a socialist? No, I'm not a socialist. But I am saying that some of what I have, I need to give back. Some of what I possess, I need to figure out how to do. And so I'm in a whole different framework now as I work with Gordon Parks Elementary. Gordon Parks has some of the most desperate kids in our community, come from Sister Berta's center right there. And I see them day after day coming with nothing, coming with no food, no clothes, barely. And I'm saying to myself, what do I have? What do I possess? And so I go through my house, and I give up this, and I go through my wallet. I say, okay, I don't need this Time Warner cable bill. Friends, half the stuff we have, we don't need. And half the stuff we have, we could give away to someone else. Half the books you have in your library, the magazines you collect, the clothes you collect, the stuff you have, we could figure out how to give it in some way that really impacts other people. So I think that's one issue. It's America's wealth. We continue to want more, want more, want more, want more. I heard last night on Channel 13, they listed the richest men in America. And you know, at some point you have to say, what man, as he's facing the end of his life, likes having that as his epitaph? Lesson two from my wife's death: a life well spent. We didn't put on there how much she was worth. No one talked about that at her funeral. What we talked about was a life well spent. What's a life well spent? I give. I go tutor. I go read. I give up my time because someone gave to me, because someone provided for me. Someone gave me, and so I go back and I give. And friends, you must understand, I could work in the White House. I could be far from Kansas City right now, but I choose to be right here doing what I do because I know what it's like to come from squalor, and I know what it's like to pray for a daughter or to pray for whatever. I know what that's like. Number two, the second reason I'll focus on, I tell you this, there's a many. But number two is our inability to change. Our inability to change. Now, I'm working with the Google Fiber. I chaired the education task force for the mayors, the mayor of Kansas City, Kansas, Kansas City, Missouri. And after I got into that, there were days when I said, you know, I should just drop this. I should just quit. You know who my toughest groups were to talk about change, but talk about how we integrate technology into the classroom? You know who my toughest audience was? The superintendent. You know who my second toughest audience? The principals. And you know what? The toughest, even beyond the principal and the superintendent, you know what? Teachers. You see, we are human beings who like the familiar. We like it the way it is. We want things to be the same. And so you have teachers who were taught in the industrialized cookie-cutter model that all kids get the same thing. We line them up in rows. They listen to one instructor at the front of the room. That model worked for me. That model must work for this generation. And so friends, we can't move. Kansas City, much like other places, we won't make the progress because we don't have this notion that change is good sometimes. And so, friends, we're talking about bringing into Kansas City, Kansas, and Kansas City, Missouri, things like this, where students can have access to math and science and get it in ways that they can't get it in the classroom. Let me tell you one. Christina, when she was at a number of the schools, she would annually fail math. Math just wasn't hers, just was not hers. So we get to homeschool, and the great thing about homeschool is that you don't pass to the next subject matter until you've mastered the current matter. And so repetition is important. And so after the 10th time on some very maybe mundane to you and me math problem, she gets it. And there's great jubilation. She's excited as that boy who gets a girl, a sister, to the point where math fear is greatly reduced. So I saw my girl graduate from Harmon High School with an A in calculus. Change. Change the model. Change how we do it. So homeschool for her, repetition, dad saying, let's try again, was key. And so in her high school, in many high schools in Kansas City, Kansas, kids have their laptops because Apple has agreed to provide Kansas City, Kansas high schools and junior high with laptops. Friends, you can go early in the morning and you can go late at night into the parking lot at Wyandotte High School, Sumner High School, and it's not just kids hanging out. It's kids who are doing homework because that's the only place there's a Wi-Fi connection because they can't get Wi-Fi at home. And Starbucks is not in their neighborhood. So friends, let me wrap this up. a wealth-accumulating country that doesn't know how to share that wealth with systems that greatly need it. And a system of adults who are so rooted in how they were educated that they can't embrace new technology for a new generation. You see, I'm analog-brained. I am. I don't quite understand this. I use it. I have the Kansas City Star, the New York Times. I have all my magazines. My library is here now. But I don't know how this works. I just use it. My kids, even my grandkids, are digital babies. I have a beautiful 2-year-old granddaughter. She grabs my iPad with no fear and maneuvers it. We must learn how to embrace the change that me and you don't understand. Because our world is moving towards the Jetsons. Whether you like it or not, everything in the Jetsons movie has been patented or is in the process of being patented. I can't slow it down. Governor Brown last year signed into law that the automakers in his state could build the first flying car. I can't slow that down. But friends, I do want the children in my community to be able to have access to technology. And so to the adults that will listen to me, I say relax. Change is okay. It's okay if we don't understand. It's fine. So, friend, those are two very simple reasons. And I implore you, and many of you probably in this room, like A-Ray, give back enormously to this community. But there are other ways that we can be more generous with time, talent, and what we have to give. And those of you that just resist technology, I say, come on, let's have some conversation. Because there are some kids, this is what they live by, whether we like it or not. Friends, I'm glad to be with you this morning. I'm glad to have this opportunity, and I'd certainly entertain a few questions if you have them.
You're listening to Professor Bernard Franklin talk about America's educational system. We owe you a few messages. Let's take a short break. We'll get right to them, and then we'll come back for the question and answer session with Professor Franklin. You're listening to the All Souls Forum here on KKFI.
Wednesday night is Arts Night on KKFI. At 6 p.m., it's Art Speak Radio, followed by the award-winning From Arc to Microchip at 6:30. Then it's live radio theater on L.A. Theater Works from 7 to 9 p.m., followed by chamber music with Dr. Mike. Get your arts on Wednesday night on KKFI.
I'm Mark Levitt. This week on Action Speaks, Underappreciated Dates That Changed America, we look at the creation of the first large-scale yoga retreat in America and its effects on contemporary yoga.
I think Nike stole yoga's real original thing, which is just do it.
Stretching to Bliss, Action Speaks.
That's Thursday at 5 a.m., right before Artie's Morning Buzz.
This week on the Heartland Labor Forum, it's the Scrooge Show. Kansas City Jobs with Justice is selling votes for this year's Scrooge Award. Find out who's in the running to be named the greediest, cold-hearted CEO, politician, corporation, or one percenter who truly exemplifies the spirit of Ebenezer Scrooge. Tune in to hear campaign speeches and how you can vote. That's Heartland Labor Forum, Thursday, 6 p.m., rebroadcast Friday, 5 a.m.
Good morning.
Good morning. I wanted to ask you about what's known as the shareable society, the fact that there's a lot of organizations out there that are based on sharing, and then the corporate pushback to people sharing with each other.
I'm not familiar with the sharing society.
It'd be like Airbnb and hostels and different organizations, different ways that people are coming together and just sharing, shared vehicles when people have the zip cars and things like that.
I need to read up more on that. I'm sorry. I'm not that familiar. So because we are in this public space, I don't want to say anything. Because, you know, sometimes speakers, we jump into something and We have no knowledge. I'll be real honest with you. I'm not there. Thank you. I apologize. Hi, friend.
Good morning, Dr. Franklin.
How are you?
I'm good. As you know, it's 2.5 years now since our friends from Google descended on Kansas City, Kansas, and declared a great celebration.
Yes.
Having followed the MBIT closely, as you know, I've been giving a lot of thought about, you know, what's transpired, what we anticipated or hoped for versus perhaps what we're experiencing. So I guess I'd be curious. Obviously, wireless and fiber all have enormous potential to deal with the education issues you talked about. But down on the ground, what is your sense of where we are 2.5 years later?
That's a good question. Thank you. I could go in a number of different directions, but let me just say that I think all of us had great anticipation that Google would come into Kansas City and transform our city, our region. What we failed, I think, to understand is that Google is a business, a corporation like many others, and Google has to make a profit. And so what we thought would be giveaway, what we thought we would get being the initial first city or first region, we had some misconceptions, even from the mayor's office all the way down. Google is not giving away anything. We're going to have to purchase and buy it. What they gave us, though, was an opportunity for us to figure out how a community wraps its arms around technology. And what we're not seeing is that being played out. Part of it is a line. That desperate line impacts us in so many different ways. That state line does. So much so that what Kansas is doing, Kansas City, Missouri is not doing, or what Missouri is doing, Kansas isn't doing. So we're not seeing it. But in some real tangible ways, we're beginning to see companies and organizations come together and have some real impact. The first school district that was rolled out with Google as its fiber connection was Piper District this past fall. We're learning a lot about how that technology can really impact a district. So there's bits and pieces that's beginning to unroll, beginning to unfold. Sprint, Google, and the Community Foundation announced recently a $1 million grant fund to allow organizations to begin to have some conversation. We just finished the first round of those grants. The announcements will be made, I believe, next week. We're excited about those announcements because they're going to really show that there's some real collaboration happening in our community. So things are happening, but probably at a slower pace than we really anticipated. And part of that has to do with our Midwest communities' inability to take risks as fast as we probably could. And I'll stop there. Good morning.
Good morning. Is there a chance or a way of a solution for the non-changing of people that you're talking about as far as education, as far as teachers, administrators, and everybody else locked into something that they've always had?
That's a great
question. You ask people of my age, or not even my age, say about card, IDs. Oh, I don't know anybody that wouldn't have an ID. That kind of thing. How do you change that?
Yeah, how do we change anything? Innate in human DNA structure is the fear and anxiety around change. So change impacts everything in our lives. We are a set of human beings who like, as I said before, we like the familiar. We like the comfort of knowing that I know tomorrow, I know next week, I know next year. It's very uncomfortable for a lot of us to live in gray. You just happen to deal with somebody who does. And I think in some ways, some people who come from distressed backgrounds, we've lived in gray so long that gray is comfortable. And so for me, I grew up in gray. I kind of know gray. And gray, I mean, you're not really sure of the next day. You're not really sure of tomorrow. You live in a fog. I've lived there. I know what that's like. And so I still, as an adult, in my early pre-retirement, I still embrace the gray, embrace change. But for the vast majority of people who live in pretty stable lives, pretty stable neighborhoods, we're not going to move that. I think part of how we do that is have conversations like this, where we engage and challenge each other to look and think. Not all change is bad. Some change is worth our having some serious conversation about how we enter. I believe, if I could take a risk, I believe it's important for a community like ours, a country like ours, to have conversation about our people having access to health care. I believe that's critical. But you and I know there are people who oppose it because they want the free market of allowing people to choose or allowing people to go buy it. But friend, you know well there are people who can't afford it, who are people in. I've served on Truman Medical Center's board. Truman is our indigent hospital in this community. They consistently run millions of dollars in debt by taking care of people who don't have access to health care. So that's one issue. We must, as a community, come together to talk about how we change systems, change models, change how we live, how we work, so that everybody can live comfortably. So, again, I'm not a socialist. I'm just saying, how does America, with all of its wealth, come to a place where we can have these hard conversations about change so that we can do things more efficiently and more effectively? Sorry for the long answer, and you had to stand so long, sir.
Working where you do, you understand the necessity for students to have certain needs to be met before they can be in a classroom in a learning situation.
Yes, sir.
How would you assess our school districts in this metropolitan area ability and willingness to provide those kind of support services so that their students can learn?
We're getting better at that, sir. We're realizing that students can't learn if they don't have the basic nutrition in their bodies to begin the classroom day. We're understanding that. It's taken us a while to get there, but we're beginning to understand it. We're even, if I could even go back further, we're even beginning to understand that you can't take a fourth grader, a seventh grader, or a ninth grader and try to get them to their grade level overnight. As a country, we must figure out how we do preschool better, how we get students into the pipeline at grade level. So by the time they get to third grade, by the time they get to sixth grade or ninth grade, the struggle is not so difficult. So we're understanding better that we need to have better assessment all along the way for the students who come in disadvantaged. And many districts are getting there. But again, it's old models. It's old forms. We put money where money shouldn't be. I'm not a real brick-and-mortar guy. And I think we have too many bricks and mortars around our system. We need to figure out how to do less, do more with less brick-and-mortar, and especially with technology. Because you can that's one of the advantages of Google. You could take technology and pipe it into places, even like this. We have had great conversation that in the urban core, there's probably more churches than any geographic region of our section. Why couldn't those churches that only operate basically on Sunday have facilities open during the week where we could pipe in some things so we don't have to build new buildings? So we're getting there. We're understanding it. But it's just taking us time to get there. Yes, sir.
You mentioned about the schools and the Wi-Fi.
Yes.
One of the things I think most people are aware of, we had a forum on Google some weeks ago, and Google is not really addressing that market. They don't want to address that market. But I accidentally came across something a week or two ago. Comcast, Infinity, or Xfinity, I guess it is, has recently... and I didn't even know it was there, and they haven't really played it up. They have X-spots or hotspots all over the United States where you can just, like, my home is 2 miles away from the closest hotspot, but yet I can use that hotspot. So they evidently are looking to address Google's competition with a totally new technology. What happens if somebody goes to Xfinity, who plays up their community benefits, and says, okay, any student that has the tool, the computer, can log on. We'll give them a password so they can log on and to use this system in their own home. They can't use it for anything else. It's limited to what they can use it for educational purposes, but they can use it for that. Why doesn't somebody go to Xfinity and Xfinity, they can come out and say, Google doesn't care about your people. We care about you, and we're offering this service. But it's a fantastic program, and I'm not sure what they're going to do with it. Right now, I found out about it accidentally.
Right. I can't speak for Google, and you probably should have Google come if you want to know what they're thinking. But it appears that they may be more interested in residential and commercial and not necessarily hotspot development. So one of the suggestions I would give is to play this back to you and to challenge you to make that effort. One of the things, as I'm learning about all this, is that sometimes we can pass on good ideas to other people, or we can wait for somebody else to do it. Why won't you make a proposal or get some people together? Your brother, a couple seats over from you, has been very involved in that. Why don't some of us who are analog babies just figure out how we get into this play? So maybe you make the effort, you get some people together, you figure out how Xfinity can impact our community, but let's not wait. I think that's part of the challenge that the Midwest has, is we're always waiting for somebody else to take the initiative. Let's just take it. Let's just do it. Let's not wait for somebody else from Harvard or MIT to come here. Let's just do it. Good morning.
Good morning. So I'm a public librarian. Here in the metro area, and I just wonder, what role do you see in libraries in this whole educational system?
You know, Crosby and I have this conversation on a regular basis. There's a library system in Chicago, and you may be familiar with it, that has really taken on a community significance. It loans or lends every kind of personal or rehab thing that a community might need. For example, you need a jigsaw. You can go to this library. You need a paintbrush. You need instructions about how to do whatever. So this community has come to understand their library is more than books. It is a resource for information. It is a resource for bettering myself. It is a complete open arena for getting ahead. And I think that's where we're going. I think we've not been real fresh about how libraries can really be a vibrant part of our community. I think the Kansas City system that we have in place is moving in that direction. I know at the Bluford Library there is a section for health care that people can come and do their blood pressure. That's what libraries should be for people who can't access technology at home. But they can come to the library to get their blood pressure checked. They can come to the library to connect with their doctor instead of going way over to Truman or way over to St. Luke's. Let's go to the library, because the technology that we're about to embrace will allow me from home or from a remote site to connect with my doctor and have all my initial tests. When I need more tests, I have to come in, but I can have that initial visit. So I think we have some progressive people in the library system here that's going to really move us in some tremendous ways and really open up the arena so that they don't become just brick-and-mortar shells, but students and parents and refugees and people who are really wanting to learn can access it. So I'm really hopeful that our system could create a real model here. Thank you for the question. Yes.
First, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Aesthetically, I really enjoyed your final image of the Jetsons and all of their trinkets being patented. On another level, I'm not real crazy about this attitude that everything has to be patented. An earlier remark that you made was about our continuing desire to continue collecting and get more and more and more. And you also spoke of change. How do we change this element of a culture that says acquisition is everything? Do you have any comments
This is what I'm appreciating about your community here. I think this is how change happens. I should tell you, I've grown up in traditional African-American urban churches, and I've come at this point in my life to be so against how even churches are set up because we don't have enough of this dialogue. In too many places this morning, there'll be a bobblehead standing here that'll be given instructions to people, and people will leave having little opportunity to challenge that. And we go and we take that back with little opportunity to say, what, if, how, can, what if we thought some other way? And so we just consume in kind of a social, I call many places, and I know I'm off topic here, I call many places a country club. They're more than, they're just basic country club social Sunday morning opportunities for us to network, but not really to change our perspectives about how we serve man. This is my point of view. You've asked me to come here. You're not paying me, so you get what you get. To your point, though, let me tell you what futurists are thinking. Futurists see the Jetsons as the next suburb, and we see it being played out. The wealthy already now want to get on one of the rockets and go circle. We see it now. We see the wealthy wanting to get further and further away from the serious issues in the city. We see it. So in some ways, it's already being framed. What we thought was a cartoon could easily have become the next vision for what our world looks like. It's not just our ability to consume. It's our ability to grasp and learn, but at the same time, misuse that grasp of learning. Now, there are things we can learn from space exploration. There are things that we can learn from going to Mars. There are products. There's new advances in medicine from all of that. But why do we have to add greed to it? And why does it have to be something that takes us away from defining? See, I'm of the opinion, again, you get me? I'm of the opinion there's not a single issue known to man that our resources can't take care of.
There's time for two more questions.
I firmly believe that. And you read, if you read the paper this morning, we have a foundation in our community that is very generous. And you can go and read it. I'm not going to name it. You can go and read it. But I think even with their resources, if we figured out how to articulate that and appropriate those resources, we could take care of a lot of problems. But we continue to go this way instead of saying, folks, how can we come together to solve our basic problems? It's not out in the space. We're just going to have more stuff out there. It's just going to be bigger because we haven't learned how to take care of them here. All right. Yes.
Good morning. I'm just a visitor today, and I wish there were more people here because this is fascinating, I think.
It is.
I'm an educator. I work with high school students most of the time, and I deal with college choice a lot, and I realize that the cost of education is getting ridiculously out of hand, I think, for college. Do you think it's necessary for every student to go to college? Because there's not that many degrees that you need for professions. Can we go more toward the technical voc-tech thing like Europe is doing? Because it's just costing people a fortune to do this.
Well, we just had a conversation this week at the Kauffman Foundation on higher education and innovation, where Cerner was the center of the conversation, saying to the area institutions, higher ed institutions, it's taking you too long to get me a good employee. I can't wait 4 years or 5 years for you to do that. Cerner, you all know, and you, those of you that don't know, it is one of the premier health technology companies in the world. Right here in Kansas City. They average, forget the numbers, and since I'll be on the radio, I don't want to say anything that somebody may call and say you had it wrong, but they import significant numbers to the Kansas City region because Kansas City is not producing enough. So the conversation was had was how do we take high school students and connect them with MCC Longview to create Central Missouri's Missouri. It's a collaborative. I think it's MCI or MIC, Missouri Innovation Center, Missouri Innovation Center. So those students graduate from high school with a two-year degree and go straight to work at Cerner. So we're having those conversations, but again, I will tell you, it's because of our age group that we're not moving far enough. Because what teachers are hearing is that you're working me out of a job. What college professors at MCC are hearing is I won't have a job because there'll be fewer kids at Longview. They'll go to Missouri Innovation Center. And so, friends, part of this shift is we have to realize there will be some cost to us as we move forward. But the greater good is what do we leave behind, is what do we support, is how do we help. So, yes, not every student should go to four-year, and not every student should have $150,000 loan debt to pay for. Yes.
Good morning.
Good morning. You're the last question, I think.
Thank you. How can we help young people and young couples make the connection between the actual cost, both financial and in terms of time and energy, of bearing and raising children so that our household sizes go down and that each child has a nurturing household that can afford what is needed?
Ma'am, you know what I'm trying to describe here begins at home? And I don't know, I probably could have brought it to you in a sterile textbook way and said parents need to do some of this educating themselves. I probably would have done that 5 or 10 years ago. But having worked with my daughter and was so concerned that my daughter could bring me home an unwanted, or not unwanted, but not ready grandchild, I worked really hard at talking to my daughter about those issues, about life, about sex, about living, about money. It took me hardship, real challenge to say, I really need to get in my daughter's face about life. We avoid that even with our children. I could tell you if I had more time. When I was dean of students at K-State, the bank there, First National Bank, called and said, Dr. Franklin, would you talk with this student who has too numerous overdrafts. I called the student in, and the student was from one of our wealthy counties. The student said, as long as I had checks, I thought I had money I could write. That was a clear example to me that we're not just talking about urban kids who don't have the necessities for living in life. Suburban parents are too busy to even give their kids the basic understanding that a checkbook does not mean you have access to unlimited wealth. We need to have these conversations as parents. We need to sit our children down and talk about money, talk about life, talk about children, talk about what it's going to take. See, the challenge that we have, in a real sense, friend, and this is the crux of the matter, that we have ours. We will go home tonight and we'll go to bed. Our children won't know if they'll have health care. Our children won't know if Medicaid or Medicare will be existence when they're... Our kids don't know if they'll have Social Security. Our kids don't know if they'll even come halfway to our standard of living. And we're not having a conversation at all with them about how in the world you're going to live with less. After I've provided everything for you, how in the world are you going to live? We're not having those conversations. And so, friends, I would say to you, the person that you give a tip to at a restaurant, have a conversation. The person you encounter, the young people you encounter, have a conversation. Because I promise you, they're not getting it at home, and they're not getting it at school. Don't let a single child walk out of your presence without you having a conversation about the future. And I don't point often, but I'm just pointing because I want to make my point that we as adults have to make sure the next generation understands they will face issues beyond anything we've ever faced as a country, beyond the Depression, beyond World War I or World War II. They will face challenges, and we must educate them. My pleasure to have been here.
You've been listening to the All Souls Forum, featuring Professor Bernard Franklin talking about our education system, what's wrong with it, what needs to be done, a very enlightening program. for you on this show. Tune in again next week for another All Souls Forum at this same time and place. This program is edited and produced for broadcast by Barry Lee. Thank you to Rita Norton and the staff at All Souls for their help each week in producing this program and recording this program. You're listening to 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.